Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. The events of April have been begging us to play a nice documentary called Orwell Rolls in His Grave. And so we shall. I hope you'll stay tuned. April is the cruelest month, said T.S. Eliot. On April 16, a staid establishment bipartisan blue ribbon panel concluded that, since 9/11, the United States has engaged in widespread, systematic torture. Entirely illegal torture. Torture without justification. Torture without even any discernible benefit. Torture ordered and conducted by the Bush administration, including George W. himself. Then, a couple days later, all the torturers were smiling at the dedication of the George W. Presidential Library and Museum. And there was Obama and Clinton and the other ex-presidents thanking W. and praising W. And the corporate media was ooing and awing about all the celebrities and W. and his wonderful new monument. From the mainstream media came not a hint of any possible objections to W. Bush's record as a president. Like, oh, let's say, torture? No corporate reporter asked what the American people gained by spending $3 trillion and a million lives to destroy Iraq and half-destroy Afghanistan, a project that continues under Obama. Speaking of money, also in April, with great praise from Wall Street, Democrat Obama announced a plan to cut Social Security benefits. This supposedly is to show that he's serious about cutting the federal deficit. A couple of problems here. First, Social Security has no connection to the federal deficit. Social Security is an entirely separate system with its own funding sources. It's totally separate from the federal budget. It has no connection to the budget deficit. Second problem. Sane economists agree that the federal deficit is a small and not very pressing problem at the moment. The big problem is massive unemployment. Neither the government nor the press is even going to talk about the real problem, let alone do anything about it. So, the plutocracy wants the 99% squeezed even more. Obama tries to please his masters. Obama announces cuts in Social Security, and the corporate press praises Obama's courage. I won't even mention that the corporate press just got even more monopolistic, with cable TV giant Comcast buying up 100% of NBC Universal, with the approval of the Obama administration. Anyway, that was in March, not April, so I won't bring it up. Back in 2006, back when Bush was torturer-in-chief, Robert Kane Pappas produced an interesting video documentary on the corruption of the news media and the corruption of government, and how both serve only the rich owners of the economic system. If the month of April wasn't enough to persuade you of this point, well, maybe the movie will help. We'll hear major sections of it this week and next. Adapted to radio by Lynn Gurry of Unwelcome Guests, here is the documentary. It's called Orwell Rolls in His Grave.
They could be made to accept the most flagrant violations of reality, and were not sufficiently interested in public events to notice what was happening. George Orwell, 1984.
We falsely think of our country as a democracy when it has evolved into a mediocracy.
Danny Schechter, former CNN and ABC News producer.
Where a media that is supposed to check political abuse is part of the political abuse.
Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies, NYU.
These commercial entities now vie with the government for authority over our lives. They are not a healthy counterweight to government. They are as big as or bigger than government, and they work closely with government.
Charles Lewis, former 60 Minutes producer.
The most powerful special interest in Washington today is the media, because not only do they give money and lobby and do all the things that industries do in Washington and companies do, but they, of course, control whether or not a politician's mug gets on the tube. Now, that's power. That's the ultimate power in a political realm, is controlling perceptions.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
In George Orwell's novel, 1984, Winston Smith worked at the Ministry of Truth. But his job was not to ensure that truth was preserved. Quite the contrary. His job was to alter past news stories so that the version of the truth given by the ruling elite, the party, was never contradicted. If the party, which Orwell called Big Brother, lied to the people, a quick check of Winston's altered records, the only remaining records, would prove that the lie was true. Can lies become truth? Could a media system controlled by a few global corporations with the ability to overwhelm all competing voices be able to turn lies into truth? These corporations are not answerable to the people. Only the politicians can regulate them. Could corporations possibly buy politicians with campaign contributions? Contributions so large that the politicians would allow unregulated corporations to go about their business of eliminating less powerful voices until only one voice remained. One truth. I read about a man named Charles Lewis, an ex-60 Minutes producer, who had created a unique nonpartisan news organization. The Center for Public Integrity broke the Clinton-Lincoln bedroom scandal. He had also done a report on George W. Bush's SEC violations for inside trading.
In the 60s, 3 in 4 Americans trusted their government. Today, it's 1 in 4 Americans trust the government. The level of secrecy and the amount of money in our process is greater than it's ever been. Archibald Cox, the Watergate prosecutor I interviewed for our book, The Buying of the Present 2000, said the level of trust in this country is worse than he's ever seen it, including during Watergate. People sense, I think, that the financial elites and the political elites have become one and the same, and that the people themselves have no voice in Washington or in their state capitals, that they are somehow being left behind.
When we think about democracy in the United States, we oftentimes, and I think certainly in our media culture and our political culture, the assumption is that the type of democracy we have in the United States is the only type that could possibly exist.
Professor Robert McChesney.
It's the high watermark of the human race is capable of, is U.S.-style democracy. In fact, though, I think we have, both in theory and in many ways in practice, a fairly, what you call, a weak democracy. I mean, in fact, in many ways, we have a frighteningly weak democracy.
Mark Lloyd, former NBC reporter.
There is an unfortunate sense as well of powerlessness, that there really isn't very much that can be done about the state of things.
You can't have 280 million people and say that two political parties represent the thinking of 280 million people. That's just think about that. If you want to just step back and look at that.
Michael Moore, documentary filmmaker.
And you know, the thing is that anthropologists, they're going to dig us up hundreds of years from now, and they are not going to understand us. No, seriously. And we've made a huge mistake inventing film and videotape because we're leaving behind a record of ourselves.
We have a situation in which a significant percentage of the population doesn't vote, doesn't care about the issues, is tuned out entirely, is what we call depoliticized. In fact, we have a rate of depoliticization in the United States That must make a tyrant, like in, you know, Indonesia, envious. They say, how can I get one of these vegged-out populations?
The top 1% that controlled 90% of the wealth had two major political parties doing their bidding for them. And the other 99% had no political party on the ballot representing them. And no representation in Congress representing them. And yet that 99% ran around waving little flags going, we're free! We're free! We live in democracy! Woohoo! Oh, we're going to look like No, seriously, folks! We got to leave a note behind and explain our actions!
We have more instant access to information as consumers and as citizens than we've ever had in the history of the country.
Mark Crispin Miller.
That does not necessarily mean we're better informed. And that's a fascinating irony by itself.
There's an apposite quote from Dr. Goebbels. That's a kind of an explosive, you know, thing to invoke here. But he said once, and this is an example of how sly he was, that what you want in a media system, and he meant the Nazi media system, is ostensible diversity that conceals an actual uniformity.
The truth of the matter is that increasingly what we see, what we hear, and what we read is being controlled by fewer and fewer large multinational corporations.
Bernie Sanders, U.S. Senator, Vermont.
People don't appreciate this. You know, in the last days of the Soviet Union, you had dozens of newspapers, dozens of magazines, all kinds of radio and television stations. The only problem is that all of that media was controlled by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union or the government of the Soviet Union. We are moving in that direction.
There is an illusion of choice that's maintained when you can have 100 channels on your cable system.
Aurora Wallace, professor of communications, NYU.
You know, how many movies did the studios release a year now? All these different studios and the music industry with so many labels and magazine stands that go on and on and on forever. Well, the owners are, you know, a handful, five, six different companies.
And that is a very dangerous development for those of us who believe in a vibrant American democracy.
Fewer and fewer people vote. When polls tell us that fewer and fewer people understand the political process, what the media does is trivialize what goes on, sensationalizes it, makes it entertainment, rather than saying, look, the function of the media is to educate you to live in a democracy, which is pretty serious stuff.
You got a media system that's basically a subsidiary of corporate America. That's all it is. You're going to have a media system that will not cover stories of tremendous public moment, while it will overfocus on trivial stories that don't have any resonance at all.
In terms of the political process, you ask yourselves, what are the most important issues facing our country? Why is it? Simple question. With all of the growth in technology, with all of the wonderful globalization and free trade, all of that stuff, all of the increases in education, why does the average American today work longer hours for low wages than was the case 25 years ago? Simple question. Do you think it's seen on television very often? What about the morality of 1% of the population owning more wealth than the bottom 95%? Seen that?
In a New York Times editorial, Princeton economist Paul Krugman addressed one of these little mentioned issues. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, between 1979 and 1997, income for families in the middle rose 9%. Income for families in the top 1% rose 140%. Krugman noted, quote, I know from experience that even mentioning income distribution leads to angry accusations of class warfare. He then asks, why has the response to rising inequality been a drive to reduce taxes on the rich? Good question. According to Joan Didion, news is no longer just reported but managed in a way that sets its terms and shapes its overall content. Has the mainstream media become an anti-democratic force in the United States.
What you want to say is, if you have a self-governing society, a democratic society, what does that society need from its journalism? I mean, what are the attributes you need to have from your journalism, from your media system to produce, so that people can govern their own lives effectively? And I think there are, you know, two or three things that jump out at you if you study the matter at all. And they're really not debated. One, you need a really hard watchdog. You need a journalism that keeps track of people in power and people who want to be in power.
Hitler says in Mein Kampf that the people's power of forgetting is enormous. This is the case with mass society, right? You have to have a healthy media system in order to counteract that natural tendency. You've got to have that, because then people will be sufficiently roused by the notion of having to protect their interests to pay attention. Otherwise, if it's just a spectacle, you know, if it's just a bunch of razzle-dazzle and bullshit, people will naturally, you know, forget about it in a couple of days, and that's the pickle that Americans tend to be in.
A CNN Gallup poll conducted in March 2003 found that 51% of the American people thought Saddam Hussein was personally responsible for the September 11th attack. Why did they think that?
Forget about forgetting. They don't know. They don't know. I picked up my local paper today. Yesterday there was a vote in the House of Representatives which would, if it carries into law, provide hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to a handful of families in this country. It wasn't mentioned in the newspaper. The repeal of the estate tax. Half of the benefits of that repeal will go to the richest 0.1% of the population. All of the benefits will go to the wealthiest 2% of the families in America. You got that? 98% of the families do not pay one nickel in estate tax. I walked down the street a couple of months ago. Guy goes up and he says, Bernie, I'm really angry at you. You know, why are you angry? I've got $20,000 in the bank and I want to leave my money to my kids, and why are you stopping me from doing that? $20,000. This guy's not going to pay one penny in estate tax. People don't know that. So what they do is they poll. They got very good pollsters, and you play off the general ignorance of the population. People don't know much. Death tax sounds pretty good. Everybody who dies, you got to pay a huge tax to the federal government. Not true.
We put the death tax on the road to extinction. The death tax is a bad tax.
And yet that 99% ran around waving little flags going, we're free! We're free! We're living in democracy! Woohoo!
Charles Lewis.
Your job is, if you're at the network, to cover the basics. The basics mean that government, the entire federal government with millions of employees, is boiled down to the White House and the Capitol. You have a reporter at each place, and they're on every night. And that's the extent of your federal government news coverage. It's idiocy.
Shocking.
It's shocking and it's pathetic. And so you can have an SNL scandal that goes on for years and no one notices it because that's an obscure, now defunct agency called the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. Well, how many reporters do you think are down there covering that? Hardly any.
If a member of Congress gets an appropriation for $58,000 in order to put some funding into a house or something, or into something in his community, it's liable to make the front pages. Congressman Jones gets pork, $58,000 for this stupid project, headlines. But when you spend hundreds of billions of dollars, it is more likely that the hundreds of billions will not be covered than the $58,000.
How did journalism get this way?
Robert McChesney.
To remove controversy from story selection. So you can't be yelled at for why did you put this in the front page and didn't cover some other story. There becomes a tremendous reliance upon official sources as the basis of legitimate journalism. This was a new thing. You know, in 1875, if the governor said something wacky, a newspaper editor would say, I'm not going to cover that. It was stupid.
Newspapers, they don't invent stories.
Peter Mitchellmore, in 1980, former New York Post city editor.
They go to people, experts in this country, for their opinions on what's coming down or not coming down.
It means those people in power, political power especially, but also business power, are sort of the assignment editors of journalism. What they want to talk about becomes news. If they agree that they don't want to debate something, like the CIA, it's virtually impossible for a journalist to introduce that as a story.
Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. George Orwell, 1984.
If the media had been on the job,
Mark Crispin Miller,
during the 2000 election, for example, if they had reported what was actually going on and reported it with all due emphasis and repetitiousness, kept on the story day after day, I don't mean the occasional piece on page 10 of the New York Times, I mean appropriate coverage where you follow the scandal. If that had happened, Bush-Cheney wouldn't be in the White House today because they weren't elected. They stole the election.
The range of inquiry by journalists was strictly determined by what the official sources were saying. In this case, the Gore campaign and the Republicans, the Bush campaign. And journalists basically, their credible journalism volleyed between these two positions. Now, the problem with that was very simple. The two sides were playing by very different rules, very different game plans. On one side, you had the Republicans, and they were committed to winning this election no matter what. Principle be damned. They were taking power, period. That underscored everything they did. So there was no commitment to being principled whatsoever. One day, if you got the right ruling by the state Supreme Court, it's clearly a state issue. The ruling 2 days later goes against you. The exact same people say it's clearly a federal issue. There was no sense of shame. The point was you wanted power, period. And it was an extraordinary propaganda effort by the right, because you couldn't even find a Republican dog catcher in Idaho who would disagree. Everyone barked out the exact same line every day. It was Joe Goebbels would have been impressed with the lockstep in which the Republican machine marched in their eagerness to take power and take this election. The problem was, for those of us who just think whoever gets the most votes should win and wanted a fair election, the journalism didn't reflect that interest. It was a prisoner of that range of debate, and therefore it played directly into the hands of the Republicans.
The BBC reported that 5 months before the 2000 election, Governor Jeb Bush moved to purge 57,000 people from the voting rolls, supposedly ex-felons.
The great story that was broken by Greg Palast from Britain, which has now been confirmed, for the first time, the use by Catherine Harris of this private company to come up with a list of felons who wouldn't be permitted to vote, which was a dreadfully bogus list of thousands of people who weren't permitted to vote, who should have been.
According to Palast, a private firm with Republican ties, Database Technology, signed a $4 million contract to provide scrub lists of ex-felons. Part of the job was to verify the list, which the firm acknowledged was inaccurate.
The state of Florida brought in this Republican firm on the excuse that they had these databases, and when the company said, well, now we want to run the databases against this list of 57,000 names, there's a little handwritten notation that says, in Catherine Harris's office, right on the listing of the database checks, it says, don't need. We will give you what they told DBT. We will give you the check if you don't check. How many of these names are wrong? Statistically, one in 20 people on the list may have committed a crime. So 95% of the people on the list, 95% of people on the list, are kind of innocent. Now, when I say kind of innocent, see, 54% of the people on the list are unequivocally guilty of being black. Now, you do the arithmetic, okay? 95% of a list of 57,700 people, 54% of them black. Catherine Harris certified the election of the President of the United States on the basis of a plurality in Florida of 537 votes. You do the arithmetic and you tell me what happened in that election.
Palast, when he first broke it, CBS News called him up. And CBS News said, yeah, we might want to work on this. And Palast said, well, go ahead, follow up on it. You can have it. Nothing happened for a couple of days, so Palast called up the producer at CBS News and said, why aren't you covering this? And the producer said, and I'm paraphrasing, well, we called up Governor Jeb Bush's office, and he said that it wasn't true, didn't check out, so we're not going to go with it.
CBS News spiked their story on the basis of a denial by Governor Jeb Bush, who was the target of the allegations.
We did not do any kind of frontal, direct investigation of the media. for 10 or 11 years.
Charles Lewis.
Mostly because our information that we put out with news conferences and things like that is disseminated through the media. So it would be, I'm being very candid here, it would not behoove me to investigate the media on a regular basis because none of the information would ever be reported and my organization would never be heard from again. And so I'm not stupid. I do recognize that fact. But I have been getting so frustrated. And I decided it was time that we looked at the media. We had half a dozen people working for 6 months, and we investigated, and we found, of course, that the most powerful special interest in Washington today is the media.
Lobbyists hire placeholders. These people line up first thing in the morning for spots in committee hearing rooms allocated to the public. A few minutes before the hearings begin, the lobbyists arrive.
These guys have hundreds of lobbyists. They have nearly 300 lobbyists, paid lobbyists, and they're giving away tens of millions of dollars in campaign contributions, and they control whether or not a politician ever gets on the air all over America. That's power.
Being successful lobbying at the FCC or Congress is as important to the bottom line as producing a movie that's a big hit.
Robert McChesney.
I mean, it's every bit as important. It's more important. That's the basically stealing stuff from government is the key. And this is where the media companies are extremely successful because they, unlike any other corporate lobby, have one thing going for them the others don't. They actually control the means by which the public can actually learn about these debates. You can imagine Exxon would love to have owned the media, or Philip Morris. So any debate over cigarettes has to go through them.
They took members of Congress on 315 all-expense-paid trips around the world. And then you have the FCC regulating the broadcast for 1,400 privately funded trips. How is the FCC going to tenaciously, aggressively regulate the broadcasters when they're taking trips from them all over the world? Well, of course, it's not going to happen. And guess what? It's not happening. The problem in this town is that a lot of the regulators that have been set up to protect the public interest have been captured by the people they're regulating, and that's been going on for years. It's not new, but it's outrageous.
Regulators, the Federal Communications Commission, almost always upon leaving office, go to work for the people they were supposedly regulating in the public interest.
Beneath the reported story of greedy Enron executives is a story about the influence of money over government regulators. This is what has happened with the media companies.
You have this contracting of ambition about what should be covered and what the public has a right to know about. The price of power in Washington, who really makes money and who really benefits from the decisions. What will pass for investigative reporting is though someone may get a hold of an early report from some committee that's about to come out, or an inspector general's report that's going to castigate the secretary of this or that. And so you'll breathlessly go on the air and, you'll say ABC News has learned or whatever the network is, and you'll be out of breath and it's all exciting. You're holding up a report and it'll look like the faceless minions that comprise the network, hundreds of them out there ferreting information out for you to serve the public. It's complete bunkum, of course. It's not happening at all. The public would never know from the media that they spent $11 million to keep any free airtime provisions out of any legislation, successfully, by the way.
Edward Fritz, head of the National Association of Broadcasters, called free airtime for candidates unconstitutional and an infringement on the broadcasters' free speech rights.
You've been listening to Orwell Rolls in His Grave, about how corrupt government plunders the people to further enrich the corporate elite, while the corporate-owned press makes sure the important stories do not get told. We'll have more next week. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Find more of us at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, and please come back again. Ciao.